everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Issue by Issue, a DC Comics Completionist podcast, the only podcast that I know of going through every important issue of DC Comics from the beginning of the Golden Age to the whenever I die eventually. I am your host and someone who will live forever, Nick Byers, as always, and welcome back, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed last week's Crisis episode. Sorry, it was a week late. There was technical difficulties, and I only had about half of my recording, which if you listen to the Crisis episode, you know that. But nothing's going to happen to this recording. I swear it. I swear on my life and this recording's life. But let's talk about this week's episode. This week's episode, we are going to be covering All American Comics number 26, More Fun Comics number 67, Batman number 5, All American Comics number 27, and All Star Comics number 5. I like that we're kind of including a JSA comic because they're sort of the only ties that the universe has together at the moment. So I like that we're including one every episode. And as we've started doing, the issues that we're skipping due to unimportance or repeatable, forgettable storylines not involving anything other than the hero, I suppose, in terms of things that have heft or weight or importance at all in the DC universe, are Flash Comics number 17 through 18, Adventure Comics number 62, Action Comics number 36 through 37, More Fun Comics number 68, and Detective Comics number 51. So, as you can notice, or as you will notice, if you listen to the dates, we're getting to a point where more important stuff is happening more often. So the dates that we're covering are getting more shrunk down. Like last episode, I think we covered several months, maybe at least 3 months. And this time we're only covering like a month and a week. Like 5 weeks. So it's pretty cool. You can see the shift towards more important stories and debuts and things like that. So as always, let's establish these in the real world by talking about what was going on during the times that these issues were hitting the newsstands. These hit the newsstands between March 18th and March 25th. So, on March 17th, the National Gallery of Art, one of the Smithsonian museums focusing on American art, or just art in general, was opened in Washington, D.C. by President Roosevelt. This is an art podcast, technically. Comic books are art. And it's fun to think that some little kids could go on a tour, on a field trip to the National Gallery of Art, and then afterwards they're going to pick up the new, you know, More Fun Comics, number 67, or something like that. And adults. Adults can go to the art gallery and then also go to the comic book shop. It's an all-ages activity. March 21st, Joe Louis, famous boxer, regarded as one of the greatest boxers of all time, defeated Abe Simon by technical knockout in the 13th round in Philadelphia to retain the World Heavyweight Boxing title. March 27th, Japanese spy Takeo Yoshikawa arrived in Pearl Harbor. Yoshikawa noticed that battleships were berthed in pairs and that the inshore ship was protected from torpedo attacks by the outboard one. This, of course, will become very important in about, 9 months when Pearl Harbor is attacked on December 7th, 1941. By the Japanese, leading to the United States entering the war. But we have got 9 months to go before we get there. So, April 7th, as has been the case, we're going to talk about a Gallup poll. The results of a Gallup poll were published by asking Americans, which of these two things do you think it is more important for the United States to try to do? To keep out of the war ourselves, or to help England win, even at the risk of getting into the war? 67% said help England. Obviously meaning that 33% said to keep out of the war. This is a 7% increase in the in favor of joining since the same question was polled 3 months previously, which we talked about maybe not last episode, but the episode before that. April 10th, the trial of Anthony and William Esposito began in New York City. The brothers faced two counts of murder for the January 14th slaying of a police officer and a holdup victim. The case was a sensation in the New York media, who dubbed the defendants the Mad Dog Brothers because they entered an insanity defense and displayed wild behavior such as walking in and out of the courtroom like apes, howling, and gnawing on their own fingers. I think maybe that's taking the bit a bit too far. The bit's a bit too far because weren't doing that before, probably. Probably just normal citizens. And it seems like maybe you were lying about your insanity defense. April 21st, the writer Rex Stout made a speech in New York City in which he attacked the isolationist activism of Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh, of course, famous for both flying across the Atlantic in a single-seater propeller plane way back when in the Spirit of St. Louis, and also for his baby being kidnapped or not kidnapped. It depends on what conspiracies you read. But he's also very much an isolationist, and he turns into not a great guy later in his life. Stout said, "I wish I could look you in the eye, Colonel Lindbergh, when I tell you that you simply don't know what it's all about. A desperate war is being fought, and the winners of the war will win the oceans. No matter what we do, we shall be either one of the winners or one of the losers. No shivering neutral will get a bite of anything but crow when the shooting stops. It would therefore seem to be plain imbecility not to go in with Britain and win." Now, this is in response to Lindbergh's, you know, very, very heartfelt and widespread and far-seen activism in keeping the United States out of the war. So much so that on April 25th, during a press conference, Franklin D. Roosevelt, the president, seemed to compare Charles Lindbergh to Clement Vallandigham, and the Copperheads of the American Civil War. Now, you may not know what a Copperhead is if you're not a historian or you don't read books about the Civil War, so let me explain it to you. So, basically, a Copperhead in terms of the Civil War was a faction of the Democratic Party, which is not the Democratic Party that you think of today. They're typically the conservatives and are very seated in the South. Obviously, during the Civil War, the Union was broken up, and it was the Union on the northern half and Confederates on the southern half. So the Democrats that were left in the border states and in other places, specifically Ohio, north of the Ohio River specifically, were known as peace Democrats. They were anti-war, and they wanted peace between the Union and the Confederates. They're idiots and dumb, thinking that just by, you know, suing for peace, that the Confederates would come back into the Union and everything would be hunky-dory. So they're silly. And it's not great to be compared to them, because as soon as the Union won the war, as soon as the Union took Atlanta, I should say, this entire philosophy of, you know, politics just went away. Because obviously they're like, oh, okay, I guess we were wrong. So back to the Lindbergh thing. Without using Lindbergh's name, Roosevelt said, "There are people in this country who say out of one side of the mouth, 'No, I don't like it. I don't like dictatorship.' And then out of the other side of the mouth say, 'Well, it's going to beat democracy. It's going to beat democracy. Therefore, I might just as well accept it.' Now, I don't call that good Americanism." Well, Vallandigham, as you know, was an appeaser. He wanted to make peace from 1863 on because the North, quote-unquote, couldn't win. Once upon a time, there was a place called Valley Forge, and there were an awful lot of appeasers that pleaded with Washington to quit because he couldn't. He, quote, couldn't win. Just because he couldn't win, see what Tom Paine said at the time in favor of Washington keeping on fighting. So, not great to be both compared to people who wanted to, you know, have peace with the Confederacy and slavery, and people who didn't want the Confederate Army to fight for, which later became the United States of America. show. Not great for Lindbergh, and obviously his reputation just gets ruined after this, so much so that people kind of discounted his other activities like flying across the Atlantic, which, no offense to him, I feel like a lot of pilots probably could have done it. So now that we have sort of established everything and what's going on, all of the goings on, obviously I skipped a bunch about World War II just because it's just like minor skirmish on this day, minor skirmish on this day, Yugoslavian coup d'etat, you know, stuff like that. So let's talk about the first issue and story we're going to be covering on this episode, which is All American Comics number 26, released March 18th, 1941, with a cover date of May 1941. We are covering it because it is the debut of Sargon the Sorcerer, John Sargent, and a lesser known hero. He has had a couple of sort of legacies or reinventings of the character, I think most recently in the New 52 in the John Constantine Hellblazer series, where Sargon the Sorcerer was a woman. So that still has some sort of standing and, you know, name recognition in the DC universe. So I figured we would cover his debut. And it's actually a pretty good debut, as far as debuts go. The art itself is very good, very detailed for the time, which I like, because some art can get pretty, I don't know, muddled back then. Speaking of the creators, this Sargon the Sorcerer debut story was written by John B. Wentworth and art by Howard Purcell. Howard Purcell does good art from what I'm seeing in this Sargon story. So let's get into the actual issue itself. It starts with a little blurb, basically giving a quick summary of what Sargon the Sorcerer is all about. And we see him, and he's wearing like a full tuxedo and a red cape and a yellow head scarf with a red sort of gem in the center. And it says, "You have heard of the Blarney Stone in Ireland. Anyone who kisses it has a gift of a flattering tongue all the rest of his life. But have you heard of the Ruby of Life? From it, Sargon derives his power over man and beast, the living and the dead, and only Sargon himself wears it." So we then get a explanation of the history of the Ruby of Life. It was 4,000 years ago at the Temple of Azareth, which I think is just a coincidence. That sounds a lot like the words and place that Raven comes from, Azareth. It would be cool if they were like, "Oh yeah, remember Azareth, the goddess of the Tipperans from Sargon the Sorcerer's debut? Let's name that," but I think it's just a coincidence, which happens a lot. So the Temple of Azareth, goddess of the Tipperans, Tipperanes, had this jewel, this Ruby of Life, that whoever touched the stone and muttered the ancient formula had power unlimited, as we shall see. But things were not all right. On a black day came the untutored, so no tutoring there. They're getting by through in school all by themselves, you know, no tutoring needed. The untutored savage Aryan hordes struck swiftly from the mountains of the Blood King to the east, and the Ruby of Life was stolen from the holy statue of Azareth and carried away and lost for centuries. When in the probably 1600s, 1500s, it was part of the treasures brought by the Aztecs to bribe the inhuman Spanish conquerors. I like that they called them inhuman Spanish conquerors, and I don't think that's them critiquing colonialism and genocide of native peoples in Americas, in the Americas and everywhere. But I do like reading it that way, that, you know, John B. Wentworth was just like really, really progressive in terms on his stance on colonialism. And it disappeared from those hordes until the year 1917, when a lone archaeologist explorer found it deep in a cavernous cache, dug no doubt by one of Montezuma's faithful followers. And like archaeologists of the time, And maybe still today. I don't know. I don't know any archaeologists. I don't want to cast aspersions against archaeologists. This archaeologist stole it, smuggled it back to America, and his name was Richard Biddle Sargent, and he made it into a necklace for his beautiful fiancée, who wore it on a gold chain suspended round her snow-white neck. They eventually get married and have a son, and that son is born, as most sons are. And this gem on this necklace was the first object his baby eyes looked upon, which is like, I don't know the mechanics of that. So he comes out the womb, and then he's got his eyes closed, but then he doesn't open his eyes until this scene where he's, you know, just sitting in his mom's arms, not in a hospital or anything, just like at their house, just been keeping his eyes closed. He's like, I want the first thing I see to be super cool. So he opens his eyes and he sees this rupee of life, and then he reaches out and touches it. It's the first thing he touches with his actual hand, because obviously other things have touched him because he is a baby and can't go anywhere by himself. This young baby grows up. This John Sargent grows up and, you know, goes through school and high school and college, and he's a good athlete and a good student, and he follows in his father's footsteps and goes on exploration trips and becomes an archaeologist himself. And one day, he is studying cuneiform tablets, which cuneiform is like a pictographic language, I think similar to hieroglyphics. I could be wrong. I'm not a cuneiform expert. And he discovers the secret history of the Ruby of Life. And he calls in his mother, who is old now, but the comic doesn't make us think that she's old and ugly. She's old and beautiful. It says it multiple times. John Wentworth is very, very into this older woman. And she, you know, John explains to his mother the story of the Ruby of Life. And then he talks about an old superstition around it, or the old superstition around it, like its power, where it's like if it's the first thing a baby saw and touched, consciously saw and touched, that baby would have absolute power if they, you know, do a certain, like, certain incantation while holding the gem. And so he does this. Suppose I was this baby, and now that I'm grown, I put my hand upon the stone like this, and I mutter the old incantation. To whom doth the ruby belong? 'Tis mine. Sing the song of the strong, Leonine. Fight the forces of wrong, malign. Sing the song of the strong. Which that's, you repeated, but all right. His mom says that Tifranians, poetry isn't very good, but, you know. So what's that supposed to do, she says, basically. And he says, oh, it basically just makes me able to, like, force anything I touch to do whatever I want, even if it goes against the laws of physics or reality. So he touches this plane on his mantle, and he says, fly around the room, plane, and it does. And at first he thinks his mom is playing a prank on him, having, like, rigged this plane. She's like, nuh-uh, I haven't. And then he says, all right, well, plane, go back to the mantle. And the plane goes back to the mantle. And he's like, oh my God, what's happened? And he's like, ah, we gotta hide this. We have to keep this a secret. People can't know, otherwise, you know, bad things will happen. They'll kill you. Your drip is too powerful, Sargon. They'll kill you. And so he's like, what should we do? What should we do? Oh, I've got it. I'll become a stage musician. Because, not musician, magician. A stage magician. Because people think, oh, he's just very good at magic. You know, the things he does. Also, it makes it very easy to do magic on stage. And so he is going to become a magician, but he has to think of a name first. He's like, a name. He's like, Sargon. Sargon is the name of an old Tifranian priest king. I'll be Sargon the magician. And his mom's like, well, maybe you should be Sargon the sorcerer. I think it rolls off the tongue better. Which she's right. The alliteration is good. And so we then sort of cut ahead to after years of training in actual stage magician practices, even though he doesn't need to do that, although that is really buying into the bit and making sure that your cover is as sound as possible, because people are like, how do you do the trick? Show me the trick, or otherwise it's real magic. And so then you can show them the actual trick. So I think it's actually pretty good that he went and studied stage magic. And he, you know, he's playing small towns and making a living as a magician to, I mean, I guess hide the fact that he has this power. He could just not use the power. He didn't have to, you know, because he's not, because here's the thing. He doesn't really set out to fight crime. Nothing in at the beginning before he becomes a magician is to fight crime. It is purely to hide the fact that he has this power. But here's the thing. He could just not use it. But I guess it could, there could be an accident. He could accidentally use it sometime. And I guess being a stage magician is still a pretty good cover for everyday mishaps with the powers. So, because he's not thinking about fighting crime. So he doesn't need to hide his identity in order to, like, stop fighting. To, like, to not be seen as his actual identity when fighting crime. Because we'll see, he just kind of sort of inadvertently stops crime in at the end of this issue. So, it's been 2 years since he started his stage magician career, and he's so good at it that he's now playing the big time. And no, not Las Vegas. Chicago. Chicago. One night in Chicago, they call it. And after the show, after his show, he's heading to his dressing room when he hears voices from inside a room. And he runs down the stairs to this room and overhears some thugs threatening the owner of the theater, Mr. Schoff, S-C-H-O-F-F, or Scoff. I read it as Scoff every time, but I don't think his name is Scoff. Schoff. It could be Scoff. I don't know. And they are, you know, saying, hey, give us 50% of these profits, or we're going to, you know, you're going to have some time some in this barrel. So they've chained his knees to his chest, and they're putting him in a barrel. They call it doubled up in this barrel, which, yeah. And, you know, they say, give us 50% of the profits. And, you know, he mumbles behind his gag. And one of them punches him in the face. And then I thought it was a typo. But then as we see throughout the rest of the issue, it's not a typo. One of them says, that's telling him boob. I thought it was Bob. I thought it was Bob and it was a typo. But no, this dude's name is Boob. Like, I doubt that that's his, you know, Christian given name or whatever. But if I was personally giving myself a nickname, if I was going to be a gangster, it wouldn't be Boob. Because when did, I don't even know if you can find out when that word started being used as a reference to women's breasts. I don't know when that happened. If it's not prior to 1941, then that's fine. But if it is, then you're basically calling yourself a breast, which I think is a very weird nickname to have. Because it's not like he's, you know, round or anything. He's just normal human male proportions. So, all right. Well, Boob does a good job punching this guy in the face. And Sargon is out, you know, watching through the keyhole, and he uses his powers with these pins that he has for his act. And he says, you know, stick them where it'll do the most good. And the pin, like, flies through the keyhole and pokes Boob, I'm assuming, in the butt. And he says, yow. He says, yow. And he yells at his partners and says, all right, who's doing this? Who's poking me in the butt with this pin? And Sargon sends another one in and gets another one of the guys. I think his name is George. And then finally, they're all like, they're fighting each other. Like, who's poking me? Who's poking me? And then finally sends one more at the third gangster, whose name is Nick. But that doesn't mean that all Nicks are evil. I'm not evil, even though I have the hairstyle of someone who is evil. Bald. And Sargon makes this little quip. He says, they can't say Sargon plays favorites. He's an equal opportunity poker. Sargon then touches the keyhole and has it expand so he can walk through it, which is pretty cool. He doesn't get small because he can't do that. He can't affect his own body. But he makes the keyhole get big and he walks through. And they're all shocked. They're like, I could have sworn this door was locked. And they check it and it is locked. And Sargon's like, well, I'm a magician. I did a magic. And that's how I'm here. And one of the guys, I think George pulls out a gun and says, I'll show you a magic trick, chum. See the gun up here, which I think is a pretty good line. He's like, yeah, watch this magic trick. I'll make a gun up here, and I'll make you dead. And so Sargon stalls, you know, like, because he's kind of space thing. I heard what you said, all this kind of stuff, so you're not going to get away with it. And the entire time he's just slowly backing up and then touches a barrel behind him. And he thinks a command, because he doesn't have to say it out loud. He can just think it. And he has the barrel roll under the one with the gun. So the barrel, you know, bowls over George, and Sargon gets the gun. And then he says, I'll show you my next trick. And he turns the gun into a rabbit. And this scares Nick and Boob so much that they rush out of the room, along with George, who has picked himself up. And Sargon gets Mr. Shoff out of the barrel, and he's like, oh, I'm so sorry about the trouble. And Sargon's like, oh, shoot, I forgot. I was so fascinated with my tricks and stuff, I almost let them get away. So he rushes out of the room to the staircase that, you know, came down to this room, and he makes the stairs, like, flat, so that it's, like, more like a slide. And they all slide down those stairs and knock themselves out. And then he tells Mr. Shoff to call the police. And Mr. Shoff is like, Sargon, you really are a magician. And then Sargon gaslights Mr. Shoff and says, no, really, Mr. Shoff, I assure you, it's all an illusion under the stress of such excitement as your eyes are bound to play tricks on you. I'm just a stage magician, no more. And then in the final panel, he's bragging to his mom about how good he was at gaslighting Mr. Shoff. And his mom's like, do be careful, John, dear. With power... Do be careful, John, dear. With power such as yours, well, it frightens me. Truly, it does. So that is the end. That is the debut of Sargon, which I think is an interesting concept for a character, because we've seen magical characters before, right? Dr. Fate, Zatara. But I think the problem with those two, Zatara specifically, is that he's too powerful. He can do anything. Whereas Sargon is just a guy, but he can affect objects. And I'm assuming people, he didn't do anything affecting people, but he can affect objects. So it's not like he can fly or disappear or turn invisible, or read people's thoughts, or anything like that. He can just affect physical objects. He basically has, like, telekinesis, but more telekinesis. Obviously, he can change matter of objects into a rabbit, say, or other things. But I do think it's interesting, and I think it's good. I think it's a good concept. Sargon doesn't pop up a lot more in sort of... I don't think he has any sort of... a rogues gallery or anything like that. So we might not see a lot of him anymore going forward, just because I'm assuming that the rest of his adventures are pretty similar to that. But I do like him as a character, having never known anything about him before. Like, this is the first time I'm learning about Sargon the Sorcerer, other than the one that I've read in the New 52. So yeah, it's nice. It's good. It's good. Now let's move on to our next issue, which is going to be More Fun Comics number 67, released March 25th, 1941, with a cover date of May 1941. And the reason that we are covering it is that, speaking of magic, we get the actual origin story of Dr. Fate. Dr. Fate, for the entire run that up until this point, has not had an origin. He has only been Dr. Fate. We have known nothing about him and his past. We finally get that. The introduction of Kent Nelson. It's very exciting. On the production side, this story was written by Gardner F. Fox with art by Howard Sherman. So, let's get into it. So, this origin story of Dr. Fate starts with a young boy, Kent Nelson, with his father, Sven, in the Valley of Ur, U-R, which is in Egypt. In the year 1920 or thereabouts, they are investigating the pyramids because Kent's dad is one of those conspiracy theorists who doesn't believe the Egyptians had the ability or the knowledge or the technology to build the pyramids. aka an idiot. But he's not an idiot because in this one, or in this fictional world of comic books, he's not wrong. He's correct, well, as we find out. So they wake up one day, tomorrow, they say, tomorrow we go down into the chamber of history of this old temple. There may be something in there that tells us of, you know, the people from another world, another planet that built these pyramids or helped the Egyptians build these pyramids. So the next day, they head off to this temple, and Sven finds some language, not hieroglyphics, not Babylonian, not Chaldean, nothing like that, a new strange language. So he's got his little notebook out, and he's transcribing the symbols from the walls into it, and Kent, being a boy, decides to go and explore in the temple. Or the Chamber of History, or whatever that they called it. Yes, Chamber of History. And he finds this statue of a man, sort of frozen. And this man is dressed in blue and gold. He's wearing like a loincloth, sort of, or like, I don't really know if it's a loincloth. It's more of like just like bottoms, like really short shorts with one of those things that hang in the middle that you see on like, Egyptian people or Roman people or Greek or people. Well, those are togas, but I'll post a picture for Primo panels. I'll do that, and so you can see it. But he also has the circle symbol that Dr. Fate has on his chest. And suddenly a beam comes from this statue, from his eyes, into Kent Nelson's face, and he's like, oh, I can understand him, yet his mouth doesn't move. He wants me to swing this lever. And he swings the lever, and a hiss of gas happens, and the man starts moving. And he says, thank you, young man, for what you have done. I can now serve the world again as I used to. And this strange man explains to Kent that he learned the secret of molecular control of one's body. His age is close to 500,000 years. So 500,000 years. I was born on the planet Celia, C-I-L-I-A, as she swung in her orbit past the Earth. Now, I don't have to tell you that there's no such planet, and why would it swing past Earth? Yeah. And so Kent deduces that he must have helped build the pyramids. He never says whether or not he did, but we should just assume that he did. Kent brings this strange man back to meet his father, who has died. He's just dead now. He's just dead now. And the guy explains, when these chambers were built, a poison gas was prepared so that anyone who knew not the secret of the chamber was sure to die. So, I guess if you don't know to go inside and pull the lever to let this guy go, you'll be killed. Which, I guess, okay. Weird. It just, that feels kind of contrived, but like, we have to make sure that Kent doesn't have a father, and instead he sees this guy as his father. So they bury him. They make a regular tombstone where it says Sven Nelson, 1870 to 1920. So he was 50 years old. And then instead of sending Kent or going back to America to stay with relatives or something, he just stays with this guy for years until he turns into an adult. And it is explained that Kent is a good student from this guy whose name we don't have. He doesn't have, oh yeah, he does. Yeah, it does. Nabu the Wise. So this is Nabu, but wait a second. Okay. As soon as we're done with the origin, I'll explain why I said wait a second. Nabu tells him that his mission is to bring good, or he tells Kent that Kent's mission is to bring good to those on Earth who use the ancient magics. Wait, the mission, yours is the mission to bring good to those on Earth who use the ancient magics to do evil. Bring good. That makes it sound like, hey, you should go out and help the people that do evil. I think he means like, justice, I guess. I don't really, that's a weird way to write that. Kent is a good student, and he learned all of the magical abilities, the molecular control that Nabu taught him over the years. So he can fly and do telekinesis and stuff like that. All the stuff we've seen Dr. Fate do. We then see Nabu giving Kent the little circle symbol, that circle medallion that Dr. Fate wears, and the helmet of fate. But this origin is, of course, different than the origin that many of us think of for Dr. Fate. We think of Nabu being trapped in the helmet, and the helmet is what gives Kent the abilities and the powers and the magic and all that kind of stuff. So that is a later retcon of his origin. I would presume maybe post? Would it be post-Crisis? I don't know. I guess I don't know when that origin happens. Yeah, because this is not the origin that I think of when I think of Dr. Fate. I think of Nabu, you know, Lord of Order, being trapped in the helmet. Not trapped in the helmet, but being in the helmet and imbuing anyone who wears it with the moniker of Dr. Fate and all the abilities that come with that. It then sort of hand waves that he left. He left this valley, and he met Inza in Alexandria when he was returning to America, and then they just kind of hung out together. So we then see years later, they've been companions for this entire time, and they're out at a bar. Kent Nelson, you know, Kent Nelson actually being a person and not just always being Dr. Fate, as we've seen previously, they're at a bar, and Inza noticed this guy who looks like he is exhausted, and he's drawn like he looks like he's exhausted. And Kent goes and asks him, you know, like, what's up? Like, do you need any help? And at first he thinks that the dude is an alcoholic. So he's seeing, you know, alcoholic visions, which happens when people with alcoholism go through withdrawals. They often see visions. I think a lot of people who go through withdrawals of any type have a lot of hallucinations of lots of kinds. He explains, this guy, that he sees the shadows of dead men, like they come after him. And he explains that he once was very into reincarnation. He was an ardent believer in reincarnation. And he made a pact with him and these guys, made a pact that if they died first, that he would help them return to life, which that's not how reincarnation works. You'll just return to life when it's your time to do so. Dumb dummies. So Kent instructs Inza to take this man to her house, or his house. Yeah, take him home. We'll take you home, yeah, to his house. And then Inza needs to wait with him there. And Kent is going to get his friend, who is, of course, Dr. Fate. And so Inza and this guy leave, and Kent flies off to a witch-haunted, an old tower in witch-haunted Salem. So the Tower of Fate. So he's going to become Dr. Fate. Meanwhile, back at this guy's house, they're there. Inza's smoking a cigarette, and the dude's looking nervous. And suddenly, the shadow man comes out of the wall and starts attacking this guy. And Inza is no help, of course. And so this guy's going to get murked by this shadow guy. When Dr. Fate busts through the window and says, "By the wisdom of Nabu, I banish you. Be gone." And the shadow says, "You, even in the netherworld, we hear of you." And so the shadow guy runs away like a little coward. But Dr. Fate said, "I must follow the shadow to make sure this never occurs again." So Inza wants to go with, of course, because she loves going to dangerous places. And as we've seen previously, Dr. Fate goes into the charnel region, so, or carnal, depending on how you say the word. So the underworld. And he finds the realm of, or the region of Black Negal, N-E-G-A-L, and just he tells him, "Hey, don't let your shadow people leave, or I'll destroy you and your dead world." And Negal laughs and says, "Oh, yeah, right." And Dr. Fate makes this skull that he's carrying disappear, and he says, "Yeah, I'll do it to you too." And Negal's like, "Okay, fine." It's like, "Yeah, no more shadows up in the world of living men." And then they leave, and Dr. Fate says, "The world of the living and the world of the dead must never mix. When they do, all nature revolts. I had to stop Nagal before he allowed his shadows to overrun this world." And then it says, "Follow the adventures of Dr. Fate in every issue of More Fun Comics." Now, let me just say, not a big fan of this issue. The origin, I feel like, should have been the whole story. Maybe the first adventure, but a better first adventure, or just not at all. I think the last panel could have just been, he dons the costume, and he is Dr. Fate. That way, the first time we ever saw Dr. Fate back in whichever issue of More Fun Comics that was, where he fought Wotan for the first time, that would have been his first adventure. Because the origin felt very rushed, right? To me, and then the adventure was just like, whatever, it's nothing. He didn't even have to fight. He just said, "Hey, do what I say, you know, ruler of a region of the underworld, or I'll destroy your skull." And he did destroy the skull, and then he won. So it's like, I don't know. It just felt like parts of it were lacking because of that, you know? So it's fine. It's not the correct origin. Not correct origin. It's not the modern origin, so it's fine. It's 1941. It's fine. So let's move on. We're going to move on to Batman number 5, released April 15th, 1941, with a cover date of spring 1941, still quarterly. And the reason we are covering this issue in this episode is because of a Joker story, and also it is the first appearance of the Batmobile with the classic bat head that we'll see for a very long time. It's making its debut in the comics, so it's very exciting. On the production side, this issue story was written by Bill Finger, penciled by Bob Kane, and inked by Jerry Robinson, as per usual. So let's get into it. Okay, so this issue starts with a great, just like, I've said this in every episode probably, but just these beginning, like, full page panels, for these Batman stories in Batman and Detective Comics are just so good. They're so good at explaining in just one image what, like, the grand conceit of the issue is going to be. And this one is no different. We see the weirdly shaped head of the Joker, and he is dealing cards, and he's holding a Joker, and he's got a Jack of Diamonds, a Queen of Spades, and a King of Clubs down on the table. And on each one is a different person. And then we see Batman and Robin running across the table towards the Joker. And yeah, and along with the, you know, blurb, which I'll read now, it really just like ties the whole issue together. I think it's really good. The Batman, mysterious figure of night who has matched wits with minions of crime, at last plays a game of cards with that supreme master of evil, the Joker. A game so deep, so crafty, that the only way to win it was to reach its climax. Can the Batman defeat a game which everyone else had thought won? Read on, and find the answer in The Riddle of the Missing Card. So yeah, that's the name of this story. And yeah, I think it ties it together very well. So it starts off as a lot of these Joker returns, he wasn't actually dead the whole time, stories start with Bruce Wayne and Robin being like, "Ah, man, it's kind of boring here without the Joker around. Do you really think he died?" It's like, "I don't know. It sure seemed like he died." And then the panel says, "No, he didn't die. He's still alive. He got out of it. And this is how." So the night that he fell through the trap door, in that carnival house's trapdoor house, the spooky house, he fell into the sewer and was washed away, presumably to his death. But he didn't die. He swam until it reached the bay, and he yelled for help until a boat, which initially the people on board didn't want to draw attention to themselves, didn't want to help him. They eventually did when they realized it was the Joker. And they explain that their current racket is smuggling jewels, diamonds, and such into the city through the harbor, like by hiding them in steamers and then getting a guy to, you know, get them out for them, and then they pick them up and stuff like that. And so they picked up the Joker when they realized he was the Joker, because they need a new racket, because the jewel smuggling racket isn't great because of the war. You know, a lot more scrutiny is made over ships and the possibility of them being sunk, a la, you know, formerly the Lusitania in World War I, I believe, and stuff like that. So they're like, oh, we should all get together, the four of us, and do crime. And it's they introduce themselves. There's a woman. Her name is Queenie. There's a man. His name is Diamond Jack, and Diamond Jack Deegan, and then Clubsy, who is the muscle. And Joker's like, huh, that's funny. I'm the Joker. So we've got the black-haired queen, so the Black Queen, Diamond Jack, the Jack of Diamonds, and Kingsy, King of the Clubs. What are the four cards? And I know what you're thinking. That sounds a whole heck of a lot like the Royal Flush Gang, doesn't it? Well, it's not. They're not the Royal Flush Gang. They're the four cards. Because the Royal Flush Gang hasn't been invented yet. But it is very funny that they did this motif wicked early, and then they return to it later with a separate gang. I don't know how involved the Joker is with the Royal Flush Gang, if they are for a while and then they split up later. But that's very funny. I find it very funny. So they are going to band together to create a gambling ship 3 miles out from the coast in international waters, so that it is not, the police can't do anything about it because it's international waters and the rules are different out there for basically everything. And so they do. They name it the Deck, because that's a double entendre, because it is both the name of a collection of cards, a deck, gambling, and the floor of a ship. You know, you're walking on the deck of the ship. So the city is mad about this, and they want it shut down. They demand it be closed. But also, coincidentally, homes are being robbed of valuable jewels, valuable gems. Because I forgot, that's another part of their plan. While they're out on the ship, they're going to rob their houses. So while they're on the gambling ship, their houses get robbed. You'd think that they would put that coincidence together, but I guess not. We then cut to the Wayne Manor, where Bruce Wayne is getting ready to go undercover. Not really undercover, because he's going as Bruce Wayne, but he's going to go investigate the ship. And he is shaving, and he cuts his chin. Now, in more modern storytelling, or I guess where in storytelling where you think that your reading audience has any sort of intelligence, you would just leave it at that. You would mention, ah, I cut myself on the chin. Ah, well, it's just a nick. But this is comics, and for whatever reason, they have to spell everything out. So the caption next to this image says, just a nick, yet it is the little nick that will save the Batman from death and enable him to bring about the downfall of an arch criminal such as the... Oh, wait, sorry. Comma, such is the irony of life. So I don't think they need that. I think it is insulting to the audience that they can't remember that he got cut on the chin, and then when it gets mentioned that he has a cut on his chin four more times in this issue, being like, huh, interesting. So it turns out that the cut on his chin saved the day. So, but we'll get back to that. He, you know, dons his fanciest suit and goes to the gambling ship, the Deck, and, you know, just comments that there's a lot of people there. And he runs into Queenie, who is acting as the hostess of the ship. She wines and dines the men who have the power because they have the money. Because she's an attractive lady. And she is dancing with Bruce Wayne. And he's like, oh, is there something more interesting to do than just, like, throw my money away? It's kind of boring. And she's like, I'm sorry you're bored. And she comments, or she thinks, oh, he's got a cut on his chin. He must have got it from shaving. Yeah, he did. And then Bruce Wayne compliments her, say she's very pretty. And she says, oh, thanks for the compliment. And she thinks, funny thing, I get the feeling that his boredom is an act, as if he were playing a part. Guess I'm crazy, but he is nice. It's like, yeah, Bruce Wayne is nice. That's true. He's a playboy, but he's a nice playboy. He's nice to everybody around because he's a nice guy. So Bruce Wayne goes out to smoke a cigarette because it's the 40s and everybody smokes cigarettes. Like, seriously. If you watch any movie from the 40s, they're just smoking all the time. But he can't seem to get his cigarette lit. So he goes into a corner away from the wind, and as he's lighting his cigarette, he overhears a conversation between Queenie, who he's just met, Diamond Jack, who he's not met, Clubsy, who he has not met, and also a white-haired old man with a beard and glasses and a purple suit. I wonder who that could be. And they are over, they're talking about stealing the jewels from Mrs. Logan, who's sleeping on her yacht, and she's got her jewels with her. She's leaving the country, and none of her help is on board because they're celebrating her leaving the country, which, like, that's not great. That doesn't paint her as a very good boss. And Queenie accidentally lets it slip that this purple-suited, white-haired gentleman is the Joker, and someone gasps from around the corner. It's Bruce. And they say, hey, who's there? Come out. And it's Bruce, and he's like, oh, I was just trying to light my cigarette. It's so windy out here. And they're like, oh, I get it. But while he's saying, oh, I get it, the purple-suited, white-haired man, the Joker. Bruce on the back of the head, knocking him out, and they throw him overboard. And for good measure, the Joker, in disguise, shoots Bruce Wayne in the water. And Bruce Wayne falls into the water dead. Just kidding. Next page, Bruce has swam underwater, because he can hold his breath and he's a good swimmer, to the wharf, and he gets out, makes his way home, dons his Batman costume, and informs Robin to don his Robin costume, and they hop in the Batmobile. And this is the first time we're seeing the legitimate Batmobile, as I said at the beginning of the issue, or the intro to the issue. It's basically a Studebaker, but it has that bat face on the front, and it also has like a bat-like wing for like the fin, like the spoiler, that area. It's pretty cool. It looks much better than just that red Studebaker or Roadster or whatever Batman was driving previously. He alternates in what he's driving. They drive very fast. It looks like it's going very fast. Back to the wharf, and they get onto Mrs. Logan's yacht, and they catch the four cards in the midst of their robbery, and they beat them all up, and they're beating them all up, doing a good job beating them all up. Batman and Joker fight, and Joker tries to use a fire axe to kill him. Batman swings him around. Robin does the classic Robin move where a big guy's running at him, so he lays on his back and kicks up like he's going to do airplane, but instead he like spins him around, makes him do flips, and gets him all disoriented, which is a good move. In the meantime, Joker has escaped from Batman, and Batman chases after him, and Robin has to deal with the rest of the four cards on his lonesome, which he can handle. I'm not worried. So the Joker hops in his car, Batman hops in the new Batmobile, and they're driving. They're driving erratic. I would give them tickets if I was a cop and also believed in cops. But suddenly, the Joker slams on his brakes, turns his wheel to the left, and blocks off the entire road, catching Batman off guard. And Batman's like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I can't stop in time. I'm going to crash into him and die. So he jerks his wheel to the left, drives through a flimsy wooden barricade and off a cliff, which sucks for the Batmobile because it just became a thing and now it's destroyed. Joker's laughing because he thinks that Batman is dead. He's like, ha-ha, my foe is, you know, done for. Now I'll have free reign of the city, all this kind of stuff. But, as per usual, we turn the page and there's Batman clinging to a tree. He's alive, of course. Back on the ship, back on the yacht, Robin actually couldn't handle all of these thugs. And Clubsy and Jack of Diamonds, or Diamond Jack, get the upper hand on him, knock him out, and tie him to a chair. The Joker returns. And Diamond Jack reveals that they searched Robin for secret weapons and they found the belt buckle radio. And so Joker's like, oh, I'll use this to make sure that Batman is dead because I'm not sure. So he calls Batman, and Batman, of course, thinking it's Robin, is like, oh, yes, Robin, what is it? And Joker's like, haha, I knew it. You're alive. And Batman's like, oh, yes, I'm alive. But if you hurt Robin, and Joker's like, I haven't hurt him yet. But why don't you come here alone? and will handle this. Which, he just tried very, very hard to get away from Batman. And then he's like, aha, he's dead. Now I can make an escape. I can make a clean getaway. And instead he's like, nah. Come to me, Batman, and I'll deal with you once and for all, even though you probably won't. So, Batman agrees to come for dinner. I don't know. He doesn't say why. He just says, come alone. Oh, he says, to provide some entertainment. So, Batman arrives, and it's revealed that they're going to play a game. They're going to play a card game. So, Batman sits down at the table, and he tells the Joker to start dealing. And Queenie, who's also sitting at the table, thinks, his chin. He's got a cut on his chin, just like Bruce Wayne. Then he's not dead. And he's the Batman? So Queenie has discovered Batman's secret identity. And the comic does make a point of saying she is the only person other than Robin to know Batman's secret identity. Which, good job. We then get into the actual game that the Joker wanted to play with Batman. And I guess the entire game just came down to who would get a Joker in their hand. Because the Joker just says the very next panel after he deals, he's like, I'm afraid you lose. I hold the winning card, the Joker. And Batman's like, I knew you wouldn't let me win. And so then he throws the cards in the Joker's face and then kicks over the table into Diamond Jack's face. And Joker swiftly makes his exit. He lights the room on fire before leaving. And then he locks the door of this yacht. And locking them all inside with this fire. Inside, Queenie's freaking out. Diamond Jack's trying to kill Batman. And Clubsy's getting beat up by Batman. Queenie doesn't want Diamond Jack to kill Batman. Because she knows he's Bruce Wayne. And she's infatuated with him. So instead, she shoots Diamond Jack, killing him. But before Diamond Jack dies and gets engulfed by flames, he shoots Queenie in the back, killing her. She collapses into Batman's arms, and it's very sad for him. He gives her one last kiss, or he gives her a kiss before she passes on and then makes his escape, his and Robin's escape from the room by combining the two chemicals on his belt to make an explosive and blowing the door off the room. They hop into the Bat boat, the Bat speedboat, to chase after the Joker, who has used a speedboat to escape. And a storm builds up, and so there's raging seas and lightning and thunder, and the Joker sees both the Batman chasing him and a place where he can, you know, safely be safe from the storm and also hopefully kill the Batman, a lighthouse on an island. So he goes there, he beats up, or he knocks out, whatever you want to say, the lighthouse keeper, and climbs the stairs just as Batman arrives and rushes to the door, seeing the Joker ascending the lighthouse. They make it to the top, and they fight. And they're fighting. They're fighting so much. And the Joker gets the upper hand, knocking the Batman over, clinging to the railing of the lighthouse by just his fingers. And the Joker says, well, you won't be able to hold for long, because I'm going to stomp on all your fingers. I'm going to crush them all with my boot heel. But, unfortunately for Joker, he forgot about one thing. And that one thing says, you forgot about me. And that's Robin. And Robin punches him. And Joker's like, all right, I'll deal with you first. And then, like an idiot, the Joker rushes at Robin. And Robin does the move where he gets low. And he uses judo. I think it's judo. To, like, flip the Joker over top of him. Off the White House. Off the White House. Off the lighthouse to his presumed death. And we see the Batman and Robin looking over the railing, being like, ah, Joker's dead again. This time it'll stick. Later that night, before we go to later that night, we have to have the Batman say this thing. He says, and he lost because he lost track of one card, but never mind that. Let's return these jewels. So now, later that night, Robin says, nope, not Robin. Dick Grayson says, what did you mean when you said the Joker lost because he didn't keep track of one card? And Bruce says, I mean the four cards. There should have been five. He had the King of Clubs, the Jack of Diamonds, the Black Queen of Spades. There's the only one color of spade. And of course, the Joker. He forgot one card. He forgot about hearts. And there was a heart. The heart of that girl who died back there. He didn't count on that, and that defeated him. And then the final panel has the caption, "But is the Joker really defeated? Or does he still live to hold a hidden trick? Only the storm-lashed turbulent sea can answer that question." And that's the end of the story. I'm presuming, and I hate to presume because it's rude, but I have a feeling that the Joker is still alive. And that might be crazy. I might be like way off base, but it just feels like he's probably still alive. I guess we'll find out, you know? So let's move on to our second to last issue for this episode, which is All American Comics number 27, released April 17th, 1941, with a cover date of June 1941. And the reason that we are covering this is because in the Green Lantern story, it is introduced Green Lantern's sidekick, who is in a lot of his adventures, Dolby Dickles, who is a short, kind of not dumb, but not smart guy that kind of feels like Green Lantern's Robin. Because a lot of, you know, we'll get the introduction of Sandman, or not Sandman, we'll get the introduction of Sandy for Sandman as a sidekick. They realize that, like, sidekicks really work really well. So Dolby Dickles gets introduced in this issue. So on the production side, we have this issue, story, whatever you want to call it, written by Bill Finger, penciled by Sheldon Moldoff, and inked by Irwin Hassan. So, let's get into it. Wait a second. It's Doiby? Doiby Dickles. Is that because he wears a derby? I'm literally just reading it. It says Doiby. I always thought it was Dolby, which also doesn't sound like a first name. Doiby. Doiby. It sounds like someone saying derby, but like with a New York accent. Doiby. I'm wearing a Doiby. You know? All right. Well, now let's actually get into it now that I actually know the guy's name. I've been calling him Dolby for my entire life of knowing who he is. But now that that is over and I have been rectified. That's not right. Knowledge has been rectified of how to say words and read them. Because, I mean, like, it's lowercase most of the time. It's capital D, O, and then I think L, B. Why? But then wait, it's not lowercase. I'm just dumb. Because I'm looking at it right now. And the way, in order to read it as Dolby, I would have to read it as capital D, capital O, capital, or like, lowercase L, capital B, capital Y, but it's all capital, so I'm just dumb. I'm just dumb and stupid. Can't believe I thought that. Doiby. Okay, so this story starts with Apex Broadcasting System, where Irene Miller and also Alan Scott work at their respective jobs. Irene Miller, if you don't know or don't remember, is Alan Scott's girlfriend. You know, they kiss and smooch and hold hands and do 1940s girlfriend-boyfriend stuff. She has been tasked with delivering secret plans for a staticless radio antenna to the laboratory out on the Sound. I don't know which Sound. I don't know if they're in New York, because I don't know if there's any sounds in New York. And by sounds, I mean, like, geographical feature, not, like, sound. Because there's some hoodlums, some nefarious men who know that the inventor carries them on his person. So, she's going to deliver them, or she's been asked to deliver them. She's like, I'll do it, because no one would think it's just a mere girl would have these plans. And they're like, yeah, exactly. But, unfortunately, outside the door is one of these nefarious men listening. Reception really needs to get their act together. You shouldn't just be able to walk up to, you know, the office of some person of high standing in a company that owns this entire building. So someone's getting fired. This man runs down and gets into a fancy touring car and says, you know, they tricked us. A girl is carrying the plans instead of the old man. And they're like, all right, we'll go after the dame. And a few moments later, Irene Miller comes down, gets in a cab, and tells them 19 Chatham Road on the sound. And the cab driver says, your very wish is my command, lady. And I'm going to read basically everything Doibe says, because it's written phonetically, like a person with a Bronx or Brooklyn or New York accent. And so he's like, gee, it certainly is a peachy day, ain't it, lady? And she says, yeah, it certainly is. And he says, look, lady, I ain't the one to point fingers, but just the same, I think that's a car folly in us. She's like, you're right. Again, these men are following us. You got to step on it. And he's like, gee, a dame in distress, just like in the movies. Don't worry, lady, I'll save you. That one sounded pretty normal. The car, the fancy touring car, catches up with them because it's just faster. And they force the car to stop, and they pull Irene out, and they hit Doibe on the head, not knocking, but scrunching his derby onto his head, and he pulls it off, and he says, when a guy smashes me Doibe, that's the last straw. Me Doibe, it's ruined. Me Doibe. Now you done it. You have gone and aggravated me beyond the limit. So he's just, like, beating all these dudes up. And he's like, touch me, Doibe, and I am not responsible for me actions. I am very vexed with all of yous. And as for you, I think you should learn a lesson. And by golly, I'm the one to teach it to you. Touch me, Doibe, will ya? And at this point in time, he's beating everybody up. And Irene has been saved. And she asks him what his name is. And he says, Doibe Dickles is the name. They calls me dad on account of, yeah, I am never without me Doibe. It's so hard. He sounds like freaking Joey from Yu-Gi-Oh. The American, the dubbed version of Joey from Yu-Gi-Oh. So they finish with their delivery, and then they go back to the laboratory so that the head of Apex Broadcasting can say, thank you, Doibe. And Doibe says, it was nothing. I seen me duty, and I a done it. Irene is then telling Alan Scott later over lunch or dinner about Doibe, and Alan Scott's like, yeah, what a nice guy, what a diamond in the rough. And that night when Doibe's on duty in the cab, a strange figure comes up to him, and he's like, I'm the Green Lantern, and I think you did a good job. And Doibe's like, huh? And then Green Lantern flies away, and Doibe's like, it was the Green Lantern. The Green Lantern. Gee, gee. The next day, Alan Scott and Irene Miller are having a conversation when they overhear a man named Barton sort of not berating, but being very forceful with their boss. Being like, sell the company to me. Do it. And the head of the company's like, no, I don't want to sell it to you. And then Barton is like, well, Wallace, you can't blame me for trying. Good day. So they're suspicious of this guy. And so Alan Scott decides to watch, like keep an eye on him as Green Lantern. So he dons his Green Lantern costume and flies off to watch Barton at his house. And he does it for several days, night after night, it says. And Barton's like, it just feels like these last few nights someone's been watching me. I'm probably just imagining things. So, time has passed, and the plans that were brought out to the laboratory have been put to use to create a test model, a test version of the staticless radio tower, and it's almost complete. So, Apex is going to send Irene back out there to get the confidential experiment report. And again, she's like, they'll never suspect it again that I'm a girl, and I'm going to go do important things. Well, guess what? They're listening in on this conversation, and Barton is informed of that. And he says, all right, well, let's get the men out there. And, well, actually, sorry, I'm wrong this time. They're not listening. They've just been keeping an eye on the laboratory, and they see that the tower is basically done. So Barton says, all right, let's get some dudes out there to intercept whatever report comes out of there. But unfortunately for him, he doesn't realize that Green Lantern has been watching and listening, and so he knows exactly what's going to happen. So Irene and Doibi are driving out to the laboratory, and Doibi says, "I hope we won't have as much excitement as this time as we did the last." Well, that's just a normal sentence, other than there's too many thises. When the gang members, the nefarious men, are going to storm the laboratory or do something to get the report, the information about the tower. When green flames shoot out from the ground and the Green Lantern appears, and they're, you know, attempting to shoot him with guns, but of course his immunity is metal, so the bullets fly out, like, you know, bounce right off of him, and then he uses green fire willpower energy to burn their butts, and they run away. And Irene and Doibi in the cab pull up, and Irene's like, "What's going on?" And Doibi says, "Switch me." The nefarious men see Doibi and Irene getting out of their cab, and then getting back into it, or maybe they don't get back into it in time, and they kidnap him, and Green Lantern sees this and tries to stop their speeding car from getting away, but it hits him and knocks him over a cliff, presumably to his death. They didn't kidnap Doibi, sorry. Doibi wakes up from being bonked on the head, and he says, "Gee, lucky me Doibi took most of the slug I got. I gotta get Miss Miller away from dem mugs." And he gets in his cab, and he says, "Gee, if only I had someone to help me. I'd rush dem mugs. Dey sure fixed a Green Lantern poignant." I don't mean to be laughing at the way that he talks. It's just, he sounds like Bugs Bunny, and Bugs Bunny is funny. And he's like, "De Green Lantern, say, dat gives me an idea. I just had a sudden thought." And he rushes to the local costumers, and he says, the customer says, "Yes, sir, can I help you?" And he says, "You certainly can, brother. Here's what I want." Then back at the hideout, Barton has arrived, and they bring him in, and they're like, "Look, we've got the dame that had the plans last time." And she's like, "Mr. Barton," and he's like, "You idiots. Now I have to kill her because she knows who I am. She knows I'm involved." And from off screen we see, nobody ain't gonna kill nobody, even in gents. The Green Lantern has come to pay you a visit. And they're like, "What? Huh?" He's like, "You don't really look like the Green Lantern. Plus, aren't you supposed to be dead?" They're like, "And since when does the Green Lantern wear a derby?" He's like, "Wait, a derby? That's the cab driver." And Doibi says, "This is positively embarrassing." But just at that moment, Green Lantern comes in. And he's like, "Greetings, gentlemen." They're like, "Oh, God, another one." And Green Lantern's like, "How about a little workout, Doibi?" And Doibi says, "It'll be a pleasure, boy, oh boy, oh boy." And they're fighting, they're punching, they're doing stuff. And they get Barton, and they take him to jail. And they did a good job. And Doibi asks, "How come you ain't dead? That car gave you an awful clout." And Green Lantern kind of winks at the reader and's like, "That's my secret, Doibi. See you in the comic books." What happened was, he's immune to metal, so it didn't really hurt him, but it did move him, and he just flew back after he, you know, fell a bit. It happens. The next day, Alan Scott and Irene Miller are talking to Doibi, and Irene says, "Well, Doibi, thanks to your help, Barton is in jail, and the staticless radio is a success." And Doibi says, "Ah, it wasn't me what done it. It was that Green Lantern guy. Gee, how I'd like to work with a guy like that." That night, after he's done being a cab driver, he goes back to his apartment and says, "Sure is good to be home. Say, where did this letter come from?" And the letter says, "Doibi, I could use a man like you to help me in my fight against all evil. How about it?" And Doibi says, "Gee, I'm gonna work with the Green Lantern. Gee." And then it says in the final caption, it says, "Yes, sir, kids. From now on, human lovable Doibi Dickles will be a constant companion of the Green Lantern. Read their exploits every month in all American comics. You'll get a thrill and a laugh at the same time." So yeah, that is the debut story of Doibi, not Dolby, because I even wrote Dolby like he's a freaking stereo in my notes. It's Doibi with an I. Okay, Doibi. Doibi. Are you tired of me saying Doibi yet? doesn't even sound like a real word anymore, because it's not. So let's now move on to the final issue slash story. It's an issue for this episode, All-Star Comics number 5, released April 25th, 1941, with a cover date of June/July 1941. As it said, it is going to a bi-monthly release schedule. And the reason, of course, that we're covering it is because it is a JSA story. On the production side, we have, it was written by Gardner F. Fox with art by Everett E. Hibbard, Harold Wilson Sharp, Cliff Young, Sheldon Moldoff, Howard Sherman, Bernard Bailey, Ben Flinton, and Irwin Hassan. Whoo! Always a lot of people involved with All-Star Comics. So, without further ado, let's get into it. As I've done previously with All-Star Comics, because they're kind of just a collection of connected but still pretty ho-hum stories, I'm going to be more in-depth on the stuff where all of the heroes are interacting and more summary of the individual chapters or stories that come after it. So, this starts off with the members of the Justice Society being bored in their clubhouse. They're in their clubhouse and they're just like, oh, crime isn't what it used to be. It's just so slow. Dr. Fate's like, yeah, no more robberies or murders. And Sandman says, do you notice how things are so slow, Adam? And Adam's like, yeah, I had time to study at college. And Spectre's like, yeah, I've just been practicing my magic just to stay good at it. And Green Lantern says, yeah, I haven't broken up a racket in so long. I'm getting the jitters. Daddy needs a hit of crime fighting. Hawkman says, sorry, I'm late. I was looking for crime, and I couldn't find any. And Hourman's like, yeah, that's why I'm late, too. I couldn't find any crime either. They're behaving themselves, those jerks. And the comic asks us, the reader, is crime finished? Have the members of the Justice Society done such a good job that all the criminals have reformed? Let's look in at an office not far away and find out. We go into this office that has a colorful collection of criminals all gathered because they are sort of connected by their rackets, specifically because Mr. X is the brains behind all of their rackets. So he tells them what to do and they do it. It's a loose connection of crime, people, and they're talking about news from Mr. X. He says they're going to get the Justice Society so they could go back to doing crime because they've been on a sort of moratorium on crime. They're like, hey, lay low. The Justice Society's too good. Okay? We got to figure out what to do with them. And suddenly, they're interrupted by he could be Asian or he could just be old. I don't know. Well, he's probably not Asian because the 1940s artist didn't draw him yellow. So an old man with spectacles in a baby blue suit and a derby comes to the door and says, pardon me, gentlemen, have any of you a match? And one of them asks, who's this? And the little derby man says, oh, a lit cigar. Wonderful. If I could be so bold as to trouble you. And he uses it to light his cigarette. And he says, thank you very much. Sorry to have troubled you. Good day, gentlemen. And the thugs are like, well, who is that? Why was he here? And the leader, or like the person in charge right now, says, all right, just sit down. I got news from Mr. X. And before I forget, take off your, he calls them dicers, which I'm assuming are hats, in his honor. And then there's a little thing that says, every time the name of Mr. X, the leader of the racketeers, is mentioned, there is a respectful silence for 30 seconds. So now, as a little experiment, I'm going to see how long that would be. Right now, let me just get the timer set up on my phone. Ready? I'm going to say Mr. X. That's a long time. 30 seconds is a long time when you're like watching the clock. And so I just don't believe them when they say every time they say the name of their leader, Mr. X, they just sit in silence for 30 seconds. It seems silly. You could be like, oh, just a moment of silence. But 30 seconds, wow. And I hope none of you thought that your recording was broken. I thought it made it very clear that there was going to be 30 seconds of silence. So he is handing this bald man, of course, who is in charge, must be Mr. X's lieutenant of some kind, hands out the assignments to all of the thugs. Muscles has to deal with the Atom. Another guy is going to deal with Hawkman. Another guy, the mystical looking man, because he's wearing a turban and a jewel like he's Sargon the Sorcerer, is going to deal with Dr. Fate. They've all been divvied up individual heroes to deal with, because it's easier to deal with them by themselves. And the comic says, well, fans, this is a fine how do you do? An organized association of racketeers. Will they succeed in destroying the Justice Society of America? We shall see. Dot, 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 dot. So many dots. And we start off with the Flash, who has to deal with arsonists. One scene I want to talk about in particular is that the arsonists have lit a building on fire, an apartment building, and it just happens to be the apartment of Jay Garrick the Flash. He quickly, you know, wakes up from the smoke and starts rushing out when suddenly underneath his bed is that man in the derby with the spectacles and the baby blue suit, and he's smoking a cigarette, and it's like, well, that's weird. And the Flash also thinks it's weird. He's like, what are you doing here? And and after he deals with that, he saves everybody from the building. Because, like, the guy in the baby blue suit derby guy is just like, pardon me, sir. And Jay Garrick's like, well, of course. Okay. So, Jay Garrick saves everybody from the burning buildings. And then, you know, using his super speed, deals with the arsonists. I'm not going to go into great detail because we all know how that's going to go. He's going to run so fast and maybe pretend to be a ghost at least once. And doesn't matter. He deals with the arsonists. What is important is that he decides, he races home after he's, you know, saved the day, and he says, now for those telegrams to the members of the Justice Society, at least the ones I can reach. So he's going to send telegrams to all of the members of the Justice Society that he can, warning them about the plans of the racketeers under Mr. X. So that's important. Next, we deal with Sandman, who the person kind of tasked with him has kidnapped Diane Belmont. One thing important about this story, and I don't know if it'll continue in any other Sandman stories, but he gets a grapple gun where like he's Batman. So he, you know, he shoots it to a far building and then swings on it, makes it much more mobile without the Sandman mobile. But Diane Belmont has been kidnapped by the guy who was in charge of the Mr. X meeting. He has kidnapped her in order to lure the Sandman to his death in a remote sort of Outlook hotel. Sandman is that's where Sandman is directed to go to get Diane. While he's swinging over there, he sees the derby blue suit man just sitting on top of a tree, and he says, pardon me. And Sandman's like, I wonder who that guy was and how did he get there? But then after that, he deals with the kidnappers and saves Diane Belmont and gets them taken to jail. And once he returns home, he sees the telegram from the Flash and says, there is a gang of kidnappers after you because you are a member of the Justice Society. Stop, watch your step, the Flash. And Sam says, a fine time to let me know after everything's happened. But this Mr. X, those fellows mentioned, maybe I ought to go out and look for him some more. Very true. Next, we are dealing with Hawkman, who is, you know, got people after him. He is working on, because he's a scientist, he is working on a duplicate set of wings and another nth metal or ninth metal belt, as he calls it, in case of emergency. And what happens is Shiera is out with some friends or out on the town when the bad guys arrive to do bad guy things. And Hawkman, you know, swoops in, stops them, But one of the guys sees him caring for Shiera and is like, all right, I can deal with this. So he shoots at them, they dodge it, and they fly away. Once they've returned home, they find the telegram from the Flash. They're like, okay, so they're trying to kidnap me. So what would be a good thing to, you know, thwart that is to have two Hawkmen. So he uses the extra set of wings and belt and gives it to Shiera. And you might be thinking, oh, okay, she's going to be Hawk Girl. She is going to be Hawk Girl, or Hawk Woman, as she calls herself in the first issue that she appears in. But no, she is just going to pretend to be Hawkman for this one issue. But we do see her in the Hawk garb for the first time, which is pretty cool, I think. So they have some shenanigans with duplication and being in two places at once to thwart the bad guys. But unfortunately, Shiera gets shot in the process. So she is injured, but she's not badly hurt. And going to take her to get medical attention and then find Mr. X. We then deal with the guy trying to stop Dr. Fate, the mystical man with the turban and the jewel. And he is doing it by being a magician. And, you know, because Dr. Fate's like, oh, fake magicians. And he is at, or not fake magician. He's going to be a magician at a rich person party. And Kent Nelson and Inza Kramer also happen to be there. Because obviously Inza is well known to be a compatriot of Dr. Fate. So he knows that he can get to Dr. Fate through Inza. So he's doing some, you know, disappearing cabinets or seances and stuff like that. When out of the curtains comes the blue suit derby man. He says, oh, pardon me, madam, if I intruded. And she's like, that's not my husband, because they were trying to contact her husband. Thistlewaite Ross Cooper is his last name. That's very funny. And in the distraction, or like during the seance, the idea was that a guy was going to shoot Inza Kramer, you know, and then that would bring Dr. Fate to, you know, the situation. And it succeeds. Inza gets shot, and they disappear in a puff of smoke. And Dr. Fate brings Inza to his tower to, you know, and then uses some magic to heal her, so she'll be okay. And then he goes back to deal with these false magicians, such as Magico, who is the name of the guy trying to defeat Dr. Fate this time. But Magico has set a trap for Dr. Fate. He has rigged the house of this rich woman that he was just at with explosives. So once Dr. Fate goes inside, he'll blow him up. And that happens. But it doesn't actually happen because he's Dr. Fate. He's not affected by explosions. He then catches Magico and scares him. Basically does a scared straight program and takes him through like cosmic horror realms where like there's fire demons and, you know, all this kinds of very scary stuff for a human guy like Magico. Dr. Fate basically then says, hey, you be good. All right, from now on, otherwise, you know what's going to happen. And he tells him about Mr. X and all that kind of stuff. And Dr. Fate checks on Inza and then goes out to look for Mr. X. Next, we have Hourman, who is once again being framed for a crime. So there's a fake Hourman out here doing fake Hourman crime and all that kind of stuff. The real Hourman runs into the Derby blue suit man and says, goody, goody, I love a good fight. Hit him again for me. And our man is confused. He is in a fight, but it's weird that this guy just showed up and said that. Our man eventually deals with the fake our man and captures all of the bad guys in tires, which is very funny. And then he runs off to find Mr. X. We then deal with the Atom, who has to deal with Muscles and his gang of really buff, tall dudes. And the Atom gets the Flash's telegram, so he knows that someone's on the lookout to, you know, get him. And Muscle's men try to kidnap him, but obviously the Atom is too strong and powerful and knocks them out. But knowing that he's needing to get kidnapped, he pretends that he actually got knocked out too. So they capture him and they bring him to this fake gym. In this fake gym where Muscles is like training Superman for organized crime. And they don't know that they have actually captured the Atom because he was not the Atom at the time. He was Al Pratt. And during this training, Al Pratt breaks every single piece of exercise equipment before leaving because he's forced to leave because he broke everything. And he changes into Atom and he beats up all the Muscle guys. It's very good. It's all classic Atom stuff. He's so strong, but he's so small. After dealing with them, he is walking down the street as Al Pratt, and he, you know, walks by the blue suit derby man, who says, "Pardon me, sir." And Al Pratt's like, "Sure, I wonder who that is." And then he's off to look for Mr. X. We then get a Johnny the Thunder text story, which I don't deal with, because it's a text story, and if you want to read text, go read a book. We then have the Spectre, who is dealing with Mr. X's underboss, or one of them, Baretti, who's a gambling racketeer who tries to frame the Spectre for a crime. The Spectre, of course, learns about this the hard way, or he learns about it and then goes to deal with Baretti, and then does not realize that Baretti has the Ring of Life, which we've seen previously in the Spectre stories. Usually he's the one using it, but Baretti is the one using it. No idea how he has it. And he defeats the Spectre temporarily. But the Spectre gets recovers and then deals with Baretti by flinging his and the other gangsters that he's with, Carr, against the tree, against a tree, killing them all. So I guess that is one way to deal with it, just by killing everybody involved. And then he goes off to search for Mr. X. We got, I think Green Lantern's the last one. Yep, Green Lantern is next. And he has to deal with a bombing raid against a city. And he deals with this by being the Green Lantern and using his Green Lantern powers to, you know, knock bombs out of the sky, knock planes out of the sky, all this kind of stuff. Classic Green Lantern things that he does. But nothing too exciting. Then, having all defeated their respective opponents, the Justice Society reconvenes at an area, and they're all like, "I gotta find this Mr. X. Where's Mr. X? Who's Mr. X? Who's got Mr. X? Where's Mr. X?" When suddenly, walking by them on the street is the blue suit derby man. And they're all like, wait a minute. It's that little weird fellow in the derby. It's like, yeah, I saw him. He was getting into my hair earlier, and he's like, "Oh, pardon me, gentlemen." And the Flash is like, "Huh, that's the guy who was under my bed, and that's the guy who walked past Muscle's gym, and I want to know how he got into Magico's seance room." And they see him walking into the police station, and they're like, "Oh, maybe he's reporting a crime or something. Let's follow him." So they follow him in, and I think, oh, he's just this little weird little guy. He's probably like saying, like, somebody, you know, somebody smashed one of his windows or something lame like that. And he's like, "Hello, sir, police officer. I've come to give myself up. Crime is not what it used to be since these men calling themselves the Justice Society of America have gone around breaking up rackets." And they're like, and he's like, "Huh? Who are you?" And then the little derby man's like, "I am Mr. X." And everyone's so confused. They're like, "What? Huh?" And he's like, "Yes, gentlemen, I am Mr. X. Just when I had a good living set for myself with incomes from all organized crime, you all had to come along and smash my rackets. You've taken my livelihood away, so now I'm going to jail and live off the state. Good day, gentlemen." Which, like, fair enough, dude. Fair enough. And that is the end. But there is one final thing in this issue, and it is important. And it says, it is a message on the final page, full page spread, and says, "And now the members of the Justice Society of America bring you this message." Our editors certainly had us guessing in this issue, didn't they? But crime and injustice have a way of catching up with their perpetrators, and sooner or later, right and justice must prevail. Now in our next issue, All-Star Comics number 6, since the Flash will soon appear in a quarterly of his own, just like Superman and Batman, the Justice Society elects him as their third honorary member, the other two, of course, being Superman and Batman. Since there is now a vacancy, who but our good friend Johnny Thunder thinks he's entitled to take the Flash's place as an active member of the Justice Society of America? And so we initiate Johnny and his Thunderbolt. And if you want to have some real fun, excitement, and adventure, be sure to get our next issue. And then it says, you know, be sure to catch all these people in their respective comics. So yeah, that's pretty exciting. Well, I mean, it's not exciting, it's sad. Bye, Flash. But it's exciting that comics are getting popular and stuff like that. So that the Flash can sustain his own quarterly instead of just one story in Flash Comics. So yeah, and so that means that also that Johnny Thunder will no longer be in the two-page text story in All-Star Comics. It'll actually be, at least for next time, Dr. Midnight. Dr. Midnight will get a little text story that we won't be reading because who reads? I do. I actually read quite a bit. But that is the last issue for this episode. You did it. You made it to the end. I'm very proud of you. And of course, if you haven't rated and reviewed the show, you are legally not allowed to pause the podcast and go listen to something else. You have to listen to all these blurbs or all these, what are they called? Like pitches. You have to listen to the end. Okay. You have to legally listen to the end if you haven't rated and reviewed the show. And if you have rated and reviewed the show, tell me and I will take your name off the list of legally required to listen to the end. Which will be good, because then your phone will be able to press pause after, you know, the end. But, so yes, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and, you know, Google Podcasts, which don't exist anymore, YouTube Music, I don't know, wherever the podcast is, wherever you listen to the podcast, if there's an ability to rate it in some way, do that, please. I don't mean to beg, but please do it. Obviously, all podcasts wants you to. I myself am bad about it. I need to get better about it. But the show is small, and growing the show can only mean better things for the show, right? So do that. Also, check us out on all our socials. On Instagram, we're Issue Podcast. Twitter, we're at Issue Pod. I've decided to continue to deal with Twitter. On Threads, we're at Issue Podcast. And then some, but not all, because there's some weird uploading problems. We're on YouTube at Issue Podcast if you want to listen to the podcast on YouTube. It's not a video podcast, so if you like YouTube and want to listen to it on there, you can do that. Not a big deal. Yes. So, until next time, I will see you all in the Crisis episode next week. As always, I am your host, Nick Byers, and you're legally now allowed to stop listening to the podcast. Bye.